The 1995 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 322, Mormons and Outsiders in Utah, 1870 to 1900, Reflections of an Outsider by R. Douglas Brackenridge, with comments by John Sillitoe.
Today, we have with us Professor Douglas Brackenridge, who is professor in the Department of Religion at Trinity University, San Antonio. He received his PhD from the University of Glasgow, and his thesis was on Sunday observance in Scotland, 1689 to 1900. He's received several distinguished service awards, and several publications. I'll just highlight a couple so we can become a little familiar with him. His most recent publication in a chapter in a book is, the title of the chapter is Presbyterian Women Ministers, A Historical Overview and the Study of Current Status of Women Pastors. And this is in Pluralistic Vision, Presbyterians in Mainstream Protestant Education and Leadership, which is Westminster and John Knox Press. And his most recent article can be found in the Journal of Mormon History, the spring 1995 issue, and that article is "Are You That Damned Presbyterian Devil? The Evolution of the Anti-Mormon Story." We're pleased to have him with us today. Making comments afterwards, we have with us John Sillitoe. He is an archivist and the curator of special collections and a professor, associate professor of libraries at Weber State University. He has degrees in history and political science from the University of Utah. He was named Weber State's Distinguished Honors Professor and Honors Service Professor in 1993. He has articles and reviews that have been published in Sunstone, Utah Historical Quarterly, Dialogue, and the Historical Journal of the Protestant Episcopal Church. He is the editor of The Wilderness of Faith, Essays in Contemporary Mormon Thought, and co-editor of Letters from Exile, The Correspondence of Angus M. and Martha Hughes Cannon, both published by Signature Books. And in addition, he has a collection that will be published, a collection of essays on Utah history, that will be published later this year by the University of Utah Press, entitled A World We Thought We Knew. We're pleased to have both these gentlemen with us, and we would like to go ahead and begin now, please.
I'll start by saying that I am not going to read the paper, so that ought to give you some sense of relief. I'm not going to read the entire paper, but what I want to do is I want to quote some parts of it, particularly the parts that deal more with the records that I consulted, but I want to tell you just briefly a bit about how I became interested in this topic. I teach religion at Trinity University, teach a course in religion in America, and I often invite people to come to my classes from different religious traditions. And I invited the Mormon president to come to my class. We became friends, became interested in the relationship between Latter-day Saints and Presbyterians, and began to do some research. And one of the things that I discovered in doing my research, because Presbyterians were very active in Utah in the 19th century, at one point Presbyterians had something like 40 day schools, and the day schools were part of to convert Mormons. So there was a great deal of activity that was going on and a great deal of literature, and I became interested in a lot of the opposition that the Presbyterians said they experienced in Utah. And in the process of doing research, I decided that what I ought to do is not only to look at what Presbyterians said, but to look at what Mormons said. So I began to study some of the ward and stake records to see what Mormons were saying and thinking about these people who had come to Utah primarily to evangelize the Mormons. So when I talk about outsiders in this paper, I'm not talking about outsiders in general. I'm not saying just anybody who came to Utah, but I'm focusing primarily on the Protestant missionaries who came in the 19th century, many of whom were Presbyterian, who went out and lived in the Mormon villages and were in very close relationships with the people. So that's a bit about the background, and the time frame is really the time frame from when the The school system began around 1870 up to the period of 1890 when public schools came in, and then that part of the Presbyterian missionary program was phased out. Initially, when these missionaries came in, they were politely received, and apparently there wasn't a great deal of conflict. But after they had begun to develop the schools, and when it became apparent to the Mormons that the Presbyterians were really here not simply just to provide an education, but to convert Mormons, then the tensions developed. And there were many accounts of the missionaries saying what the Mormons had done to them. For example, in 1880, the Presbytery of Utah complained that in towns like Logan, American Forks, Springville, and Payson, that the religious meetings were, quote, frequently disturbed by hootings through the windows, cursings against the teachers, and by boisterous singing and shouting around the doors. The Presbytery further charged that the buildings had been defiled in unmentionable ways, our property injured by stoning, and our books cut to pieces and scattered under the seats by those attending our services. And in a lighter vein, a minister told how Mormon youths disrupted his evening meetings. He says, "When we were singing the last hymn before the sermon, someone outside the window played the Arkansas Traveler on the harmonica. I motioned to my wife at the organ to continue playing, and she did so. I sprang at the door, and about 20 rowdies scattered with all their might in different directions." And there are many stories about that type of thing, of whenever they were having meetings, that the Mormons would try to disrupt it. There were other stories that were a bit more serious in terms of the death threats and physical harassment. There was one case reported in 1884 in Mendon, which actually ended up in a civil court. Late one evening, two inebriated men, apparently intent on rape, broke into the residence of a lone Presbyterian schoolteacher. After being roughed up, the woman escaped through a bedroom window clad only in her nightgown. Her cries roused Mormon neighbors who provide refuge and apprehended her attackers. Presbyterians often use this story as an example of how dangerous it was to be an outsider in a Mormon village. Now, there's a great deal of this material, and much more than what I even have here in the paper. The question that came to me was, do these accounts, do they really reflect the situation in Utah? Was this what it was like to go out and live among the Mormons? You know, were you constantly being harassed? Was your life in danger? What was the picture? So this is the point at which I decided that rather than simply rely on the accounts of Presbyterian missionaries, I would try to get at some different sources of information. So I began looking in the ward and stake records. I began looking in newspapers. I began to look in letters to try to find things where people were not just simply writing the type of literature that was polemical, that was meant to arouse emotion, but to see if there was something a bit more informative about the dynamics of Latter-day Saints and outsiders. Now, you have to remember that I did not read all the minutes. I did not cover all the possible sources, but what I did do was this. I made a map of where all the Presbyterians had put their schools. And then I took the ward and the stake records that corresponded to those villages. And I said to myself, now, if these Presbyterians were out there working, surely the Mormons were saying something about them. And although it was discouraging at the beginning because I didn't find a whole lot, as I began to plow through these and I cranked through page after page, I finally began to pick up some things that were helpful to me as an outsider myself looking in on these records. And I'll just summarize what I found and read you a few examples. One of the things I found was that when you read the minutes, when you read what people are saying, and I don't know whether you've ever read any 19th century ward records, and to me they were a revelation, because when Presbyterians keep records, what they do is they record only what the motions were. I mean, Presbyterians do things decently in order. My friend Professor Buchanan knows all about this. And when you read Presbyterian minutes, all you get are the actions. But when you read Mormon ward records, you get narrative. And in the ward records, it'll say, Brother so-and-so said this, Sister so-and-so said that, Bishop so-and-so said that. And you have all these comments that you don't get in more formal records. So for me, it was really enlightening. I began to feel as though I was in the middle of a conversation that I wouldn't have been had I been reading more formal records. What I found there was that first of all, that it was very commonplace in these meetings to denigrate Protestants and Presbyterian ministers in particular. They did not come out too well. There was hardly a meeting passed, and I only put down a few of these notes in my paper, but hardly a meeting passed in which they didn't have something negative to say about Protestants and ministers in particular, clergymen in particular, and about what Protestants believe. For example, an elder in Cedar City, quote, spoke of the ignorance of the Christian world, that's me, in regard to the knowledge of God and his Son, Jesus Christ, whom he has sent, which we are told in the sacred book to know as eternal life. A Mormon missionary, quote, spoke of the ridiculous inconsistencies of the sectarian denominations and their dogmas. He had engaged in discussions with their ministers and found them to be very ignorant and superstitious about the true meaning of Scripture. And I could go on, just all kinds like that. One Wellsville elder said, quote, all other religions now extant upon the face of the earth were made or originated from the brain of man, but our faith has emanated from God. So you realize that they weren't too positive about that. Catholicism frequently came under attack as a false and authoritarian religion. And again, in the interest of time, I'm not going to read all those, but there's some negative things about Roman Catholics. Also, there were comments about social isolation. The records were frequently saying to the people, people were commenting, that they shouldn't have anything to do with outsiders. And they particularly warned people to stay away from ministers and teachers. One writer talking about the Protestant ministers who were there in their midst said, quote, the miserable creatures who are sneaking around to curry favor and gain control of the children, and who, while with canting tongues and pious mien, they feign friendship and stimulate a kindly regard, only conceal the hatred and the malice which lurks in their hearts. There again, some other good ones. Most often what you find in the records are things like this, people saying, let the outsiders severely alone. That was a phrase that came up many different times. Leave the outsiders alone, and they will soon leave us. One speaker at the St. George Relief Society said, quote, Gentile influences are brought by visiting their homes and bringing it back to ours. What would keep them here if we let them alone? At another stake meeting, a man said, quote, if we take outsiders into our homes, we cannot hinder our daughters. But I would rather take my daughters, dress them in white, and lay them away than that they should be polluted by such associations. All right? So, again, my feeling was in reading these that they did not want to get too close to those who were not of their own community. Now, so far, What I'm quoting to you is confirms what this general, more polemical literature is saying. That is, that the Mormons did not like the outsiders did not like the Mormons, and that they were being persecuted. That's the general picture you get. Now, had I stopped there, I think that would have been my conclusion. But I pushed on, and what I found were some things that I think certainly give me a different feeling and make me curious to know more, because I don't feel as though I've understood everything yet. But I found a number of things that I think give another picture. And one thing is that over and over again in these meetings, the Mormon, the leaders, the people affirmed the principle of religious freedom. That over and over again, they said that if we want our freedom, we need to give religious freedom to other people. And that many, many times you find these comments. And again, I will not read them because of the time constraints. But they came not only from higher officials; they came from just the ordinary person, saying everybody deserves a right to speak his or her mind, and we ought to respect that. And just as I cited to you some things that were negative that come up in the ward minutes, if you read them carefully, you also find that Mormons were very appreciative of people who were not of their religious tradition. For example, I found the examples where the speakers spoke very favorably of the Muslims. For example, one speaker spoke at great length, quote, that Muhammad was a true prophet and was inspired to perform the labor which he done. And that's the English, not my English. They also found kind words for Roman Catholics. Even though you can find negative, you find very appreciative of Roman Catholics. They also were appreciative of Protestants. And just as though you can find negative things, you also find when your records that many times they were saying, we owe a lot to the Protestants. They've done a lot of good things. We ought to appreciate them. For example, one speaker said, quote, we should honor and respect and do appreciate the work done by them, that is the Reformers. Yet none of them ever claimed to do what they did by direct revelation from God. There was always some a little bit of compromise on that. But you pick up that there was a respect and there was an appreciation for people outside of their own religious community. And whenever Mormons did not respect people like Presbyterians or Methodists or whomever, I found many instances where they were disciplined and where the elders, the bishops, spoke out against such behavior and certainly did not approve it. There's nothing in the records to indicate that anybody was ever saying, go out and get these outsiders. In fact, I found exactly the opposite. The leaders were saying, we shouldn't do this. We should respect people. We should acknowledge them in our midst. And the one story that I mentioned earlier about how the Presbyterian teacher was attacked at night, there's no question that happened, and the accounts that the Presbyterians give them are very interesting. But what I did was I found in the actual Mendon ward minutes, I found a narrative of that particular event, and what the Presbyterians didn't say was that, first of all, these two men who attacked the woman were not practicing Mormons. They were not active in the church, and in fact they were drunk at the time. And according to the minutes, when the church officials apprehended them, and this is right out of the minutes, they told the bishop to go to hell. That's exactly what they told him. And the bishop said, it's a shame to think that a young lady could not come to reside in our midst without having been submitted to such outrage by hoodlums. And then he goes on and says, you know, we need to protect people who are in our midst. And he concluded his remarks by saying, to see that she wants for nothing and that she is protected in her rights. So although incidents happened, my conclusion is that what happened was they didn't emanate from practicing Mormons, but from fringe people in the community, sometimes referred to as rowdies and others, but people who were not really attending these meetings and caught up in the mainstream of Mormon life. And again, there's a number of quotations to support that. Another thing I found was that even though the Presbyterian ministers were saying that the Mormons were not hospitable, I found countless examples of where the Mormons opened up their meeting houses to the Presbyterians, allowed them to hold meetings, did all kinds of things for them, let them speak. So I began to be aware of the fact that even though there was opposition, it wasn't quite as strong as what you would get from reading only one type of literature. And again, I will not read all of those. Another source of information that was very helpful to me was having access to letters from some of the Presbyterian missionaries on the field. And these letters are available in Philadelphia at the Presbyterian Historical Society. And they're letters that the missionaries, most of whom were single women, the single women who went out and lived in the Mormon villages and taught school. And these letters are written back to the board in New York. And they're interesting because they're informing them of what they're doing, but they're also very personal. And what I found, again, in the letters, and to be fair, there were certainly missionaries who were saying things were tough. And I have letters of missionaries who tell about holing up in their room at night and being in tears because people are throwing rocks at the house, you know, that, and they're scared to death that they're going to come in and get them. That apparently did happen in some places. But at the same time, I also found that there were many missionaries who found that they were well received and they were accepted, and that they did respect the people. Just a quotation from a missionary in American Fork in 1880. She's teaching little children there in American Fork. She says, "Nearly every night after school hours, I am besieged with, 'Please, Miss Kingsbury, won't you sing and play for us?'" She further described her work: "All the time I can command, evenings after school and Saturdays, is devoting to making calls upon the people. I am always kindly and politely received, notwithstanding the people have been told," and she underlines in her letter, "not to speak to or to have anything to do with Presbyterians." You know, she knows that they're saying that at the meeting, but she said, "In spite of that, the people treat me kindly, accept me, and are nice to me." And in the same year, another missionary wrote, "In our calls upon Mormon families, we are received with the utmost cordiality, and they nearly always think to thank us for coming." And the missionary says she was somewhat unprepared for this. She thought she was going to be attacked. She thought, well, maybe there was an exception in Ogden because all the Mormons with whom we have to deal treat us very kindly. She was just kind of surprised at how that could be with what she had heard about what was going on. Again, other quotations are very similar. We have another diary or a collection of letters from a woman who was a missionary at Fillmore in 1881, and I cite a few of her letters in my paper. And her early letters, she comes out to Utah. She's never been out this way, and she's simply repelled at the primitive living conditions. And she has a line here. She says, "We are like lions among dogs." That's what she said when she came out, that she felt she was so much superior to these people. But after a period of time, as she's there for a few years, the letters begin to change, and she starts talking about how much she enjoys being with the people and how kind they were to her. Toward the end of her stay, she said, quote, "We are growing in favor with all these people and are treated exceedingly kindly." And you have to remember that there's no reason for her to say that. It's not like this is going to be published. These are just letters written to a family. So I would assume that there's no way why she would be lying to them or trying to make things a lot better than what they were. When Craig and a co-teacher needed boarding accommodations for the summer, she informed her family, quote, "You would have thought everybody in town wanted us." So I think that's a little different attitude than what you might pick up from reading some of the other records. Other women who were missionaries here said a lot of the same kinds of things, and I'll just quote one of the missionaries. She worked here in Utah for about 20 years. She said there had been a negative article published in one of the papers about Mormons. She said, "It was unjust to Mormon people and unfortunate to all concerned. No teacher who conducts herself with dignity and kindliness will ever suffer indignity at the hands of Mormons." Another missionary of some 29 years in Utah said, quote, "We may well hate the degrading system and influence of Mormonism, but never the Mormon people as we know them." So the people who were here for a while temper the kind of negative readings that I had in the first part of my paper. And I'll just read my concluding paragraph here. In retrospect, Mormon resistance to Protestant missionaries in Utah during the 19th century is not surprising. Given their past history of persecution, often aided and abetted by Protestant clergymen, their precarious existence as a new religious movement, and their physical isolation, one could hardly expect Mormons to embrace Protestant missionaries as welcome additions to their religious enclave. In spite of hostile press and intense proselytization, Latter-day Saints respected religious freedom and accepted the presence of outsiders within a very close-knit society. While Protestant missionaries often experience painful social isolation and resistance to their education and evangelistic endeavors, those who persevered eventually overcame barriers to community acceptance. Indeed, when they did not employ anti-Mormonism, their relationships with Mormon villagers were cordial and respectful. Presuppositions of intellectual superiority, social status, and theological verity, however, impeded the ability of some missionaries to grasp the unique social dynamics of Utah Territory. You'd be glad I didn't read the whole paper, right, if I talk like that. Nearly a quarter of a century would pass before Mormons and Protestants adjusted to social realities. By the 1890s, however, both groups were acknowledging changing times. Denominational leaders began to mute anti-Mormon evangelism and stress a positive Christian witness in Utah. Mormons, having rejected polygamy and having established public schools and a two-party political system, responded with gestures of friendship and accommodation. Nevertheless, stories of hostile Mormons continued to fire the imagination of Eastern audiences well into the 20th century, perpetuating stereotypes that shaped national perceptions of Utah saints. And the article that was mentioned in the introduction about "Are You That Damned Presbyterian Devil?" was such a story, and it was a story about a Presbyterian minister who said it was necessary to carry a pistol in order to preach, that he had to pack a pistol when he went to a Mormon audience. And if you have time to read that article, you find that at the end of the story, which actually drags out for some 25 years, he finally admits publicly that the pistol was metaphorical, that he says he had it, but he didn't show it. But such things, I think, make it difficult to try to peel back the layers of historical evidence and get back at what was it like for these people who came into Utah in the 19th century. What was it like for the Mormons who had to interact with the outsiders? I don't think that I have by any means come up with a definitive answer, but what I think my research is leading me to say and to try to bring into all my writing is that these oversimplistic kinds of one-dimensional accounts, you have to look beyond them, that life was much more complex, and that probably it varied from village to village, and probably it had something to do with the personality of the people involved. And I can imagine that there were some Presbyterian missionaries that I wouldn't want to have anything to do with, and there's probably some Mormons I wouldn't want to have anything to do with, and I think one has to take that into account. But it's an interesting area, and I hope that as we do more research, we'll be able to get beyond the kind of stereotype, get beyond the polemical literature, and get a deeper insight into the social dynamics of 19th century Utah. Thank you.
As Sue mentioned, John McCormick and I are editing a collection of essays about Utah history, which will be published later this year by the University of Utah Press. We chose as the title for this collection "A World We Thought We Knew," because we believe that conveyed the notion that there are many more aspects to the Utah experience than the ones we immediately think of. I wish Doug Brackenridge's fine essay had been available to us when we made our final selection, because I think it raises the kind of questions and provides the kind of insights we think are important in better understanding this state's growth and development. Brackenridge gives us a succinct overview of the forces that brought outsiders to Zion a century ago, and I'll quote from his paper a little bit. "Although most outsiders came to find wealth, some came to save souls, especially those of deluded Mormons whom they believed had succumbed to the demonic powers of Joseph Smith and Brigham Young. Included in this assault was a contingent of Protestant clergymen and female school teachers who labored during the last three decades of the 19th century to draw Mormons back to the fold of traditional Christianity. Their interaction with Latter-day Saints presents an interesting case study in social dynamics and provides an opportunity to reappraise some longstanding assumptions regarding Mormon-Gentile relationships." In the paper, Doug identifies both a key time period and a key question for consideration. As he notes, 1870 is absolutely central because relationships between Mormons and non-Mormons after the arrival of the railroad are very different than those in the decade prior to that. when outside contacts were short-lived and infrequent. The key question that he raises is, what were the actual relationships between Mormons and outsiders from 1870 to 1890? To answer that, he's turned to what I think is an important and largely unmined source, not only consisting of local ward and stake records, which have obviously been used somewhat by other historians, but also private writings and, most importantly, the files of Protestant archives. I think he's opened up a whole new area of important research opportunities for other scholars of this period of time. In a sense, the prevailing 19th century Mormon response is succinctly summarized by the Bishop of Moroni in 1882. Leave outsiders alone, and they will soon leave us. Well, it didn't work in the late 19th century, and it won't work in the late 20th century either. There's an important difference, however, between attitudes then and attitudes now. Today, the lure of dollars has convinced us that tourism, Micron, the Olympics, etc., demand that outsiders are not only particularly welcome, but we just as soon that they don't leave us too soon. You'll find that out if you're staying at the hotel when you pay your bill. In the paper, Doug introduces several key notions which help us better understand the relationship between Mormons and Gentiles in late 19th century Utah, a period that I think is absolutely crucial in understanding Mormon and Utah history. To the saints, non-Mormons are seen as sincere but not really solid in their faith. Their religious commitments are learned, not felt. Despite their differences over theology, however, the saints maintain a commitment of allowing all people freedom of conscience while claiming it themselves. It'd be tough for them to not. A recognition that top-down directions are central to Mormonism, attitudes expressed by leading church authorities filter down to local bishops and elders, is a third, I think, very valuable idea in this paper. And finally, I think another important idea is the fact that there really is an important difference between the picture of the Mormons that's presented in denominational magazines and the views of missionaries themselves. And indeed, Mormon views of outsiders are tempered as well. There is a growing, if at times grudging, respect on both sides. My own research has dealt largely with the Episcopal Church, particularly the activities of Bishop Spaulding of Utah. And from time to time, he expresses his frustration. He said, you know, I go back east to raise money, and all they want to hear about is the Mormon menace. So I have to be careful to not just say all of that stuff. But I come back to Utah, and even the slightest criticism is seen as well beyond the pale. So I'm in a difficult position. Well, okay, that's the 19th century. Have things changed? Are those things as true today as they were a century ago? I have some thoughts on that. When I was growing up here in Salt Lake in the late 1950s and early 1960s, there were still fears among the Gentiles, of which I was one, of Mormons with buckets of water coming after you. Even though I was a second-generation native-born Utahn, I still felt like an outsider. It was a feeling that colored all the aspects of my life. It was a touchstone. It was the way you made contact within your own communities. Protestants, Methodists, Congregationalists, Presbyterians, Catholics, Jews could all agree on one thing. They felt like outsiders in this state. I suspect that feeling is not entirely absent today when the population of the state is still over 60% Mormon, and in some places much, much higher than that. Of course, I recognize that statistics can mislead. I'm always reminded of the story of the small Idaho Mormon town with a saloon at each end of town. A visitor asked a local person how many Gentiles there were in this town. And he said, well, there are only a handful. And the visitor said they must be powerful drinkers then. Well, today, too often, it is still true that in Mormon circles, Protestants and Catholics are denigrated. They're seen as good folks whose faith is the product of a paid clergy and whose values are sufficiently weak so that once confronted with the wisdom of a couple of young men with white shirts and well-scrubbed faces, they will see the light and embrace the real truth. Am I overstating the case? Maybe. But how many times have you heard Mormons refer to Protestant services as cold and stark or lacking in any real spirit? I had an interesting experience a while ago. A friend of mine had to give the eulogy for her father-in-law. They had a relationship that was at best difficult and more worse than that, really. They ask her to give a little eulogy. She said, I find myself in a difficult position. How can I say what I really believe, and yet how can I say what needs to be said? I said, Kathy, you're beginning to understand why millions of the people of the world have a paid clergy. You can call on them in tough times to make those eulogies because they don't have as much invested as you do in it. Well, we've seen some involvement by the LDS Church in recent years in religious freedom coalitions and other kinds of activities. But despite that, is there any real dialogue between Mormons and Gentiles today? I don't think there's enough, at least. Now, I'm not suggesting to you that this is one-sided. I'm not here to just bash Mormons, necessarily. I'm reminded of Steve Sidorak, a Methodist minister here in Utah, several years ago, who spoke at a Sunstone session, and after the session was over, he confided to me that when he came into the room, he very carefully checked where all the exits were and positioned himself on the podium so if somebody made a quick advance toward him, he knew exactly how he could get out quick and take his pregnant wife with him. I attend Unitarian services on a reasonably regular basis, and an oblique or direct reference to the power and influence of the folks at 47 East Staff Temple is a staple of every Utah Unitarian service. I think dialogue is something there needs to be more of. One of the ironies that comes through in Duck's paper is there's much more dialogue between Mormons and non-Mormons in the 19th century than in fact there is in the 20th century. He quotes in the paper, Methodists preaching Methodist services in Mormon wards. Do any of you have the experience of having a Methodist, Presbyterian, Unitarian, etc., address sacrament meeting lately? I'm not aware of any. Maybe I just don't know. So dialogue is important. People talking is important. At that same Unitarian church, I had a really interesting experience a couple of weeks ago. Bishop Niederauer, the Catholic Bishop of Utah, came to the Unitarian church to talk about Catholicism. Now, that's a tough crowd for a Catholic, Unitarians. I mean, I wondered how that was going to play. It played out very well. He was very honest, and those Unitarians asked the bishop some pretty tough questions. How come a bunch of American Catholics are governed by a Polish pope living in Italy? What about birth control? What about environmentalism? What about family planning? What about rich, powerful churches? How do you see your role, they said? Are you a teacher? Are you a pastor? Are you just a CEO of a big corporation? He said two things. He said, heaven, prevented ever happening that I see myself as simply a CEO. Beyond that, he addressed those questions. Now, I don't know that he said things that would get him in trouble back in Rome, but he tried to address those questions. He tried, in fact, to dialogue. There needs to be more of that kind of thing between Catholics and Unitarians and Catholics and Mormons and others. I mean, it'd be a nice thing, wouldn't it, if somebody from the hierarchy came here. I mean, I'm not even talking about dialogue between Mormons and non-Mormons. Maybe a little more dialogue between Mormons themselves would be of some value. I think a final thing that comes through the paper that is also true is that like their Protestant counterparts of the 19th century, Mormon missionaries today often discover that the people they are sent to convert are not really monsters. They're actually pretty good people, and they have some pretty good traditions, and that they're struggling with the challenges of life that all of us struggle with. I was just down in Phoenix, and I was in a bookstore, and picked up an interesting book called Meditations by Thomas More, a former Catholic monk who since left the monastery. And you may be familiar with some of his books. A couple of them have been on the New York Times bestseller list. That's the thing to do, leave a monastery and write a couple of bestsellers and do okay. Let me just share with you one entry. It's very short. I've never had the impression that Jesus or the Buddha were proselytizers. It simply wasn't their style to run membership campaigns or even to network. They seem to have been less ambitious than that. Believers and followers and converts, words we use of those who have become convinced of spiritual value, run the risk of trying to make everyone else as perfect as they are. You must read this book, listen to this speaker, go to this place, become a whatever. What is it when the Spirit gets such a hold on a person that they have to convert everyone else to their enthusiasm? Soul puts reins on this tendency to clone one's own tongues of fire. Soul respects another's failure to find perfection, resistance to enlightenment, sheer ignorance of absolute truth, misguided attachments, and unrelenting meanderings. Pretty good words of advice to all of us. The theme of the Days of 47 parade a few years ago was that the world is welcome here. What a great idea and worthwhile goal. Doug Brackenridge's paper is part of a much larger work. I enjoyed it. I learned much from it, as I'm sure you did too. He helps us better understand both past and present. I look forward to additional insights and explorations in future installments. Thank you.
We do now have approximately 15 to 20 minutes for any questions. It would be great to carry on some of the dialoguing that we are having here. So I would like to invite you to please go ahead and if you've got comments or questions to make, the time is yours now.
Who were the Presbyterian ministers and teachers teaching? Were they Mormon children? And why weren't the Mormons teaching their own?
And if you could repeat the question for the tape.
Who were these Presbyterian teachers teaching, and why weren't the Mormons teaching their own? That's the question. Well, in many of these villages, the Professor Buchanan and I are doing a dialogue a little later on where we talk about
a diatribe,
that of a clash. What was the case in early 19th century Utah was that in many places the schools were very inadequate. There just simply weren't enough schools for all the people, and that in many places they didn't have a lot of good teachers. I mean, the teachers weren't floating around. There were trained teachers were not floating around. So what the Presbyterians were doing was this. They came into Utah, and again, I have a lot of quotations on this. They came in. They thought, just as the Mormons thought, that all they had to do was get up and speak and everybody would believe, they thought they would come into Utah, preach the gospel, that is, Protestantism, and the Mormons would capitulate. Well, that didn't happen. So instead of giving up, they concluded that the adult Mormons were lost causes. And they said, you're never going to convert the adults, so you go after the children. How do you best go after the children? You go to school. So they brought people in, and for example, in a Mormon village, the Presbyterian school teacher would probably, in most cases, be much better educated than the Mormon teacher, and Dr. Buchanan could respond to that. But in many cases, these teachers come in, they had college degrees, they were, you know, well-trained, so they would start a little school and be free. Well, it's hard for parents to resist that. And on top of that, they said, we are not teaching Presbyterian doctrine. We know we're not trying to convert. We're just simply here to give you a good education. Now, they were trying to convert, but they were trying to convert indirectly. You know, they hoped that they would get the kids under their influence, they would respond to them, and gradually these children would make some decisions, you know, that they would not be Mormons anymore. They were somewhat successful in that, but not terribly successful. But that's essentially what was happening, was that they were coming in, they were meeting a need, and they were at the same time, the Presbyterians, hoping that they would convert some people, and that's partly why the Mormons said, don't send your kids to those schools. You know, the Mormon bishops were adamant about not sending the kids to the school, but the people did anyway. They did it anyway, right? Oh, I think it was. I think that's what was reflected, that it actually improved relationships when the Mormons, and many of the teachers, for example, gave children music lessons, did artwork for them. You know, they did a lot of things that were seen to be very positive, very non-religious, and that the parents felt that this was really something good. The hierarchy of the church, however, I think they realized what the ultimate goal of the schools were. I think they realized that. They said to the people, don't go, because what they're really trying to do is get a hook into you that you will abandon your faith. And there were notable exceptions of where this did occur. But I would say, based even on Presbyterian statistics, which are not very reliable, even the Presbyterian statistics admitted that they didn't have a great deal of success. But what the Presbyterians believed, by the way, was, though, that the very presence of their schools in Utah pushed the Mormons to improve their own education and encourage them in the direction of public schools. That's what they argued. And there may be some truth to that, to that, to that argument. A question back?
I don't know.
Right.
I wonder if you know.
Well, let me ask a couple parts of it.
Okay.
You may be interested to know that McLeod was actually a Presbyterian.
Pardon?
McLeod was actually a Presbyterian.
Was he Presbyterian?
Yes, he was Presbyterian.
Well, yeah, was he?
Because the Presbyterians and the Congregationalists,
they had common, yeah.
Common, but he was actually Presbyterian,
right.
Although he was working for the Congregational Church. The question was raised about the presence of the Congregationalists. The Congregationalists were the other major group who had schools in Utah. The Presbyterians and the Congregationalists were the two groups. And in the passing of time, they had a kind of a comedy agreement, you know, that they didn't go into the same towns and villages. They kind of worked that out. Don't be deceived that the Presbyterians were not the only ones, but the Presbyterians and the Congregations were the only ones who really went out into the villages. The second part was a reference to the fact that there were Congregationalists active very, very early, and this can get into the story of who was first, but, you know, actually, the accounts that I have read, that when the Army came in 1862, they had a Presbyterian chaplain, and he brought with him a tent that was dedicated as a chapel, and so that was supposed to be the first Protestant service, so you could keep pushing it back farther and farther. But there was a story about Robinson being killed, and again, I think it's one of these stories where we'll probably never know the whole truth of it. But I know the Mormon side of the argument was in that case that there was other things going on besides the church work, that there was some land deals, that there was some problems over, and that that murder may have had more to do with that than had to do with anything to do with religion, but. I think, what was the last part of the? I forget. Did I answer? Oh, how many converts? Okay. Believe it or not, there are statistics, and you can take them for what they're worth. In the 1890s, I can't quote them all here, but they actually worked it out how many dollars per convert. You know what it cost, and what I can say is this: it was there were very few, and the statistics are difficult because, in the first place, what constitutes a Mormon? And that's the big question. Most of these people, I can speak for Presbyterians. For example, some of the first converts were people who had already had clashes with the Mormon hierarchy. You know, in other words, they were already disaffected from the Mormon church. So they saw embracing Presbyterianism, in my estimation, is another way of kind of thumbing their nose at the hierarchy. I mean, this is a way of saying, look, we can do what we want to do. But very small. This is one of the reasons why the Presbyterians were very reluctant to put money into Mormon missions. The missionaries in Utah had an uphill fight to get money because they could not produce the converts that they could in other territories. That's a plain fact. I know that to be. So really not so much in terms of converts and in terms of churches. The Presbyterians planted very few churches. The churches that were the most successful obviously were the ones where there was a significant Gentile community. And most of our churches that we founded in the 19th century are closed or are community churches today. They're community Protestant churches. Okay.
They were here. Right.
Well, I think you find the same, John, your point about not wanting to convert the Mormons, the same thing was said also, the Presbyterians were saying that they wanted to Christianize the Mormons, is what they were saying. You know, they didn't necessarily want to convert them.
Right.
Okay, the question was, did a lot of the negativism that I was talking about in terms of the literature, did that have a role to play in money raising? Oh, I'd have to say yes, it did, because what you have to realize, in the 19th century, the missionary enterprise was a national operation, and people like Presbyterians had missionary programs all over the country, and in Appalachia they had it, in the West they had it, in California the Presbyterians had a group of people, what they called exceptional populations, And the exceptional populations were Native Americans, Hispanics, and Mormons. Those were the three that they were willing to put some money into. But what was also happening about this time frame was that, at least within the Presbyterian Church, there was a sense by the 1890s that the frontier was over. And the Presbyterian Church was turning to the immigrants that were coming in, flooding the eastern cities, and we began to dump money into that, and so the Mormons were kind of left out. A lot of the activity in the 1890s, you know, B.H. Roberts and Smoot, all of that were really, the Presbyterians were at the head of that. If you study that, they were very much at the center of that, and part of that was to reawaken an interest in missions in Utah. So I think that's certainly part of it. I think we have to temper that with the fact that I don't think these people were just lying. I think they were trying to present, you know, it's like when you present an argument, you present the strongest argument for your side as you can. And I think there was opposition. I think these stories about, you know, stone throwing and isolation, I have a lot of stories like that I think that was true. But I just don't think it was the whole picture. I think there was much more to it than that, and I think we need to get both sides in order to balance it. Okay, one other here. Okay, we have a few more.
Just for me to get a little clearer picture, how does that work?
Okay, good question. The questions are about the dynamics of what were the dynamics of the relationships of these missionaries. They were, by and large, female. They were single. They came out, many of them, with a commitment to do at least a couple years. Some of them, as I referred to my paper, stayed 29, 30 years. That was the exception. Most of them came out for a while. They got married, usually. They usually married the Presbyterian minister, you know, because wherever there was a school, there was a church. So they often married the minister. But they did marry Mormons. I found several examples of that, and it was really embarrassing to the Presbyterians that these missionaries would go out and marry Mormons. I mean, that was absolutely... Pardon? No, only a single one. There were at one time, we had, the Presbyterians had that 40-some school. Some of them had two, you know, there were two women at a school, so there could be more than just the 40. Somewhere I have those statistics, but it was a significant number of people. You know, it wasn't just a few. The Presbyterians invested a lot of time and money into this, and in fact, it was... The Presbytery of Utah in 1877, they were the people who convinced the General Assembly, which is the national board of the Presbyterian Church, that they ought to support educational missions. Up to that point, the Home Mission Board would only support what they called evangelistic work. They would not support educational work. But because of the unique situation in Utah, they said, we will make an exception, and we will fund women to go out. And the first woman ever in the Presbyterian Church ever to be commissioned was here in Salt Lake City. She's the first one. We're just about out of time. Can I just respond? I want to respond to what John has said, because taking this up to the to the modern times, that wasn't part of my paper, but I want to make just a few comments, my own observations that may help tie some of this together, is that I do think that this continues to be a problem. It's a different setting altogether, but I think that the thing that is the most problematic for people with whom I talk, I've done a lot of interviews, and I continue to do a good bit of research here. When I have opportunities, I talk to people who are not Mormons, and I talk to Mormons as well. But it's not persecution. It's not that. That's not the problem. What most of the, of quote, outsiders, they feel as though they're just ignored. They feel as if they don't exist. That's what they tell me more often, that it's like nobody knows that they're there, and that's a difficult feeling to deal with. I had one experience when I was here in 1990. It was the first time I'd ever been in Salt Lake, and our General Assembly was meeting, and I went with a group of Presbyterians. People told us there was a nice Presbyterian church down in American Fork. It had been there since 1878. It was right on the main street by the railroad tracks. Of course, we didn't know that, but we went down to American Fork on Sunday morning, about six of us, and we went into American Fork, and we thought, we'll find the Presbyterian church. We drove around. We couldn't find it. And it's getting, you know, about 11 o'clock, and we wanted to go to the service. We didn't want to walk in late. So here we were on the main street of American Fork. I saw a police car. Well, I'll ask the policeman. So we went over, and a very accommodating policeman, I said, could you tell me, please, where the Presbyterian Church is? And he looked at me as though I was asking him where Scandinavia was. I mean, where some little town in Scandinavia. And he was very polite, and he thought for a minute, and he said, I think there's a church. He described this church to me, and we wrote down the directions and drove, and it was like Holiness Tabernacle, a little shack back up on the road. And so as we came back, there was the Presbyterian Church in one of the most prominent places in American Fork. He had no idea that that was a Presbyterian Church. And I know that's just an anecdote, but I think it says something about the feeling that these people don't exist. And I think that is probably the contemporary problem that the people feel. So I agree with John in terms of the need for dialogue and the need for both groups trying to understand each other and trying to get away from these conditions that we've allowed to build up over a long period of time. But we have time for now. Yeah, thank you very much.